Hello. I would like to thank Lily and Carol and the Freud Museum for inviting me to give this paper. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for coming as well. Can you hear, by the way? Yep, brilliant. Okay. The research that I'll be presenting today is based on my book, Art and the Home, Comfort, Alienation and the Everyday, that was published last year. It's a thematic text that explores the way that artists have interpreted abstract ideas that we have about the home, enclosure, sentiment, withdrawal, and alienation. Unusually, it concentrates on sculptural practices, with film and photography being used as further illustrations of trends. My reason for this is that sculpture is material. It is of the world and is experienced spatially and in time. Like the world that we have constructed for our dwelling places, we move around installations and sculptural objects, measure them against the scale of our bodies, and the materials used either hold echoes of their previous lives in the real world, or are part of a sensory memory that we all hold within us. It is part of our shared humanity. The key issue of this talk is the subjective experience of the world, how this is revealed in art, and how the viewer responds to what he or she sees before them. Freud, Marx, and Einstein all provided theories which underlined the notion that the world is not what it seems. This became reworked in postmodern aesthetics as it made us see that the world is not a stable fact to be visualized, but instead a constantly evolving construction, deconstruction, and reconstruction. Both the phenomenologists at the turn of the 20th century, including Husserl and Bergson, and the psychoanalytical approaches of Freud, allowed for our identities to be partially formed by situations and circumstances. This again became particularly relevant in the art of the 1980s and 1990s, when there was a growth in the making of autobiographical works in art, where the interpretation of events was allowed to be partial and situated. Ideas about what the home means have remained fairly constant and tend to be universal. They are places of ritual, where relationships are played out, and where, as Juhani Palasma has written, one returns to in order to be oneself. When positive, it is a place of safety that is not subject to the rules of the public domain, where one can choose one's possessions, arrange them in ways that reinforces one's identity, and present to selected people a narrative that we have constructed about ourselves. However, as we all know, the home is not always a positive domain, but can be a site of conflict and alienation. The alienation and the uncanny that I will discuss here will be fundamentally derived from surrealist ideas. Of course, interpretations of the uncanny have changed over time, from Freud's notion of it being an incursion into everyday normality, when something feels strange and alien, but leads us back to what is known and familiar. More recent considerations of the uncanny include the experiences of people who have migrated, where strange encounters and feeling alien are normal. For those of you who don't know, Gilbert and George are some conceptual artists who have present themselves as living sculptures in various different circumstances, and these are just two of the images that are taken in their home on Fournier Street. Gilbert and George have photographically presented themselves frequently at home in their house on Fournier Street. These photographs often concur with Freud's definitions of feeling of Heimlichkeit. So comfortable, so nice, so cozy and heimlich. It shows a place where time and money has been spent on collecting beautiful things, of creating a place of comfort that reflects back onto them about their identity, or at least that which they would like to present. Their home has, in a sense, become a museum of special pieces. They collect 19th century liturgical objects, furniture, glass and metalwork by Christopher Dresser. Their possessions provide a backdrop to the living sculptures that are Gilbert and George. Each object, loathed with the constant care lavished on these special things, and is possessioned in ways that ensure a positive reciprocity between object, function, and owner. As Tom Leddy has discussed, our earliest formations of aesthetics are about cleanliness and tidiness. We shine and clean using stroking motions to ensure that things look cared for. We arrange objects on shelves and surfaces to emphasize the narratives that we build about ourselves. This notion of value, which, as Husserl, Merleau-Ponty and Bachelard have argued, is carried around within us, and we repeatedly perform the actions that trigger our memories and imaginations. However, as Freud says, the heimlich can become unheimlich, and like that notion, it circulates around two areas, the familiar and agreeable, and that which is concealed and kept out of sight. I've included this image by the American artist George Siegel, as in many ways it underpins the overlaps between art and life that I want to explore. Like Alan Kaprow and Robert Rauschenberg, with whom he worked, Siegel wanted to meld the two areas. But for him, it was important that his art had a poetic resonance, a linking of the inner and external worlds. Here you can see a plaster cast of one of his friends, her gesture frozen in time as she looks from behind a found, worn window. Siegel made many installations of people in relation to windows, sitting by them, looking out, or being seen as if in an interior room. He was well aware of the trope of eyes being the window of the soul, an aspect which has been explored by many artists and writers. The idea of the enclosed spaces housing memories, of breaks in the walls, windows, as being places of power from which the world is framed for the viewer, and the viewer is, in return, framed for those passing by, and of things having memory value, is key to the idea of homes equating with consciousness. Returning to Freud's essay on the uncanny, he looked for different definitions of heimlich in Grimm's dictionary, and in addition to the familiar, he adds belonging to the house, but something withdrawn from the eyes of strangers. Although the figure is framed by the window frame, the enclosing walls hide the interior, just as the mind is only partially revealed to the exterior world. In Walter Benjamin's A Berlin Chronicle, he evokes walks undertaken during his childhood around different areas of Berlin, accompanied by his mother or nurse. He describes his Aunt Lehmann as ruling and entirely occupying a street close to where he lived through being constantly enthroned in her window, a mistress of all she surveyed. Benjamin would mount the steep steps to her room and wait for the brittle voice to bid him enter. His memories of the rooms that he visited and inhabited during his childhood were an insider's view and were imbricated with rituals, smells, objects, colours, tastes and sounds. These were the hooks that he returned to and mulled over in his mind, as he said, like a man digging, turning over the soil of his memories in search of collector's pieces that he could arrange in, quote, the prosaic rooms of later understanding. Benjamin became intoxicated by the ideas of the surrealists, their notions of leaving traces and of finding a new future through a re-engagement with the past that has been swept away by progress. Benjamin's writing, like the ideas of the surrealists, suggests a theatre of the domestic inhabited by ghosts and haunting pasts. You might recognise some of this. This is André Breton's apartment and the Freud collection here. André Breton, the leader of the Surrealists, famously visited Freud in 1921 in his apartment in Vienna. We know little of what was said, but clearly he was interested in Freud's collection of antiquities. Of course, many artists from the early 20th century, including Picasso and Duran, had collected African artifacts from the many markets around Paris. For the Cubists and Surrealists, These suggested a different world that played to different sets of rules. When collected and displayed, they united the symbolic with the real within the domestic sphere. The home has become a container of the world, an inside space that is both real and visualized. However, although some contemporary homes are arranged and photographed as if they were artworks, there is a difference of consciousness between our lived spaces and those that are represented as art, or presented as art. One way to consider why we perceive art that portrays the domestic scene differently to our own lived space was outlined by Edmund Husserl in his book Ideas, General Introduction to Pure Phenomenology. In this book, he discussed going to a gallery that showed the works of David Teniers the Younger. He looked from one image to the next, emotionally engaging with every scene. He argued that the frames around each work of art demarcated the world that was explored by the artist, while for the viewer each framed segment of life echoed the framing of memories and ideas in his or her consciousness. These boundaries in art that correspond with the mental states, therefore, act as a means for the viewer to enter the realm of art and calibrate the scene, ideas and materials and scale against his or her own experiences. I just want to sort of look a little bit at this work because I think in many ways it actually starts to make us understand how something moves from being from the everyday into being perceived as art and how this all links up with memories and consciousness, etc. The English artist Helen Chadwick made this autobiographical work after a series of installations where she had considered social issues. It was complex, comprising of 10 sculptures arranged in a spiral, surrounded by peach-coloured curtains. Each sculpture represented specific objects that were key for the different stages in her childhood development, in what she called the training of her physical mental being. They include objects that she could not possibly remember, like the incubator that housed her premature body, objects from her school, like the gym horse, and also things from her home, including the piano. Onto each, she juxtaposed photographic imagery depicting her adult body with scenes from her childhood. Like the ideas of Walter Benjamin and the Surrealists, the objects chosen were loaded with emotional memories. She wanted to show those that had caused her emotional stress. On a couple of pages in one of her notebooks, Chadwick listed details about her early life, and then she sought to remember the places and objects. She wrote, "Bland, impassive buildings passed through, faceless yet loaded with memories. The cold, hard, unsentimentality of the camera, truth physical but mechanical, going back." The last bit is in block capitals. Her personal museum of memories was to be presented as an archaeological representation of facts in an attempt to overcome her alienation with the world around her. She wanted to reconcile the emotional and the rational. I want to start by thinking about the change from family and personal objects from the domestic lived space and how, in this work, they become art and therefore more universal and possible interpretations. Chadwick chose the objects that were to be made into the sculptures and the related images after going through her family archive of photographs, receipts, toys, clothes and letters, and through visiting and taking photographs of key places from her childhood. Whereas her family album would have acted, like all family albums, as a prosthetic memory, capturing events to be activated in future presence, Chadwick's revisiting of sites from her childhood and taking reels of film created an archive of the present, looking back. Family photographs in the pre-digital age, and some of you I'm sure will remember this, like me, would taken to freeze a staged highlight to provide the evidence to support an extended narrative about individual identities and family relationships. One carefully rationed the number of photos taken, and when the 24 or 36 shots were taken, there was a wait of several days before one could see the results. It was all part of the ritual. The image of Chadwick, crouched in the wigwam in her best dress, with her father and mother seemingly casually standing on either side, grasping the wigwam, is sun-drenched, with doors and windows of the bungalow open and everyone smiling. Although apparently about the everyday, it is a key event. And like all events, it also encapsulates a particular social and intellectual world with its performance as a negotiation against the material backdrop. For the juggler's table, which was formed from early experiments with a family archive, the 10 miniature sculptures are arranged with associated photography on a domestic table covered with a cloth. Chadwick saw herself as a figure of the juggler in the tarot cards. In this photograph, we can see the table as if through her or the juggler's eyes. The juggler is every man who juggles with everyday items like peas, knife and dice, not realizing that they are symbolic of potentially more potent objects. In Chadwick's notes, she writes, "Why juggler acting to audience? Who is audience? Development of self as spiritual exercise within the framework of ordinary life, reconciliation." While the large installation of Ego Geometria Sum is easily perceived as symbolic, the small arrangement of card sculptures set on a table with related snapshots and formally tucked under them suggests the raw material in a domestic setting waiting to be transformed. An example of how Chadwick wanted to depict scenes that were emotionally intense is the piano, 9 years. Chadwick wrote about her hostility and resistance towards the instrument, how she was forced to practice, and how this gave her back pain. I'm sure none of you have had that. She used the metronome as a technique for self-hypnosis to regress to the, quote, unpleasant piano experiences of early years. On one side, her kneeling, naked adult body is depicted as if playing the piano. However, on the contact sheets of the photo shoot, she experiments with her arm gestures, looking defiant with arms on hips or crossed. Decontextualized hands, you can just see them here on the front of the piano, appear to touch the front, a gesture of healing that runs through the installation. The grain of the plywood shows through the photographic imagery, giving them the feeling of insubstantiality. It suggests the act of remembering as much as the memories themselves. The display of the sculptures as a spiral came from reading about Pythagoras's ideas about uniting of the spiritual and universal. It was to emulate the imagery of a planetary system with the gravitational pull of influences gradually waning over the years. Chadwick later wrote that she used the curtains to suggest a hidden space of memories and the peachy tones to imply flesh. They also promote the historic iconographical tradition of curtains indicating theatrical reality. In her notebook, she frequently questions the relationships between outer surfaces and hidden lives, between the containing space and different forms that act on the psyche, and between the tangible enclosing the intangible. She wanted the objects to suggest memories and trigger intuitive and contemplative thought in her audience. Her overriding concept was, quote, "The gallery becomes the memory. The gallery is the brain, a metaphor for memory. Walk in space equals getting inside artist's head." While the work of Chadwick was personal and painful, used ideas of traces of past linked to objects and to the present, and brought together the symbolic with the real, it did not utilize tropes and staging that would suggest the uncanny. She knew surrealist ideas and had clearly read some of Freud, but the work is mediated by a broader range of reading and influences. What I want to move on to here is how the Surrealists interpreted Freud's ideas of the uncanny and how this was then used by later artists. The Surrealists knew the writings of Freud and wanted to tap into a world that was the antithesis to the logic of the machine age that they perceived around them, one of the bizarre, the erotic, and the unconscious mind. They aimed to speak from the point of the irrational, from the place of madness itself. We know that Freud was not so keen on this idea, nor did he fully understand what the Surrealists were attempting to achieve, as he thought that to contrive the unconscious mind was a contradiction in terms. He wrote in a letter of 1932 to André Breton that the unconscious defences of the person being analysed can only be worked through in private and with an analyst. The German-born Swiss surrealist artist made this work for the exhibition of surrealist objects at the Charles Ratten Gallery in 1936. Almost immediately became an iconic symbol of surrealism. Oppenheim used a typical surrealist strategy connected with the staging of the uncanny, which also paralleled the exhibition as a whole, which juxtaposed art from around the world with surrealist objects. She bought a cup, saucer and spoon that she covered with gazelle fur. A cup, saucer and spoon are common objects that one uses daily for rituals of drinking tea. Gazelle fur is exotic and beautiful. It makes one want to touch and stroke it. On a gazelle it's fine, but on a cup it creates unease. How would it feel to drink tea through such fur? It combines two separate narratives, that of the gazelle and that of the everyday ritual. The mind attempts to make sense of the combination and fails. If one looks at both images, this one here is by Dora Maar, another surrealist artist. They're staged differently. Whereas the one on the right emphasises a normal narrative, that on the left does not. The shadow is from behind, the square table setting, the displacement of the spoon, all set it up to be a bit odd. The whole idea in surrealist thinking was to explore the mechanisms of the unconscious through exploring the languages of the dream. As Freud said in his introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, a dream is a distorted substitute for something else, something unconscious. In dreams, he argued, there is a manifest content, that which appears, and the latent, that which the mind does not wish to show. For the surrealists, it was the latent content that was so important, the underside of modernity, of the logic of politicians, the machine age and bourgeois society. For them, art was not just visual, but something that could trigger ideas and be rebellious. The uncanny, like Burke's sublime, is a paradoxical mark of modernity, where the reader is placed in a situation of unease in an apparently modern and secular context. Freud thought of the uncanny as a survival from our abandoned culture of childhood, where one first felt haunting experiences of alienation at home. He drew on the ideas of Ernst Jentsch, who in his The Psychology of the Uncanny of 1906 wrote that for a person experiencing the uncanny, there needs to be a sense of a lack of orientation within something familiar. While one takes certain everyday things as normal and self-evident, when a change of viewpoint is given, this can elicit a heightened psychological effect that he calls the uncanny. Like Jentsch, Freud considered childish understanding where there is less experience of what adults, as adults, we understand to be normal, so that things can easily appear to be alien and dark. For Freud, what is felt to be frightening and induced dread are things that have been repressed but have come into the open, or where the boundary between fantasy and reality have become blurred. Like Chadwick's Ego Geometria Sum, The French artist Louise Bourgeois described how her work was autobiographical and linked to her childhood memories, which were not happy. Her Cell series ran from 1986 to her death in 2010 and consisted of room-like structures that incorporated a variety of materials and juxtaposed found and made objects in order to create a sense of unease. In this work, we can see a reconstruction of her childhood home here, with the guillotine blade hung over it, a suggestion of the emotional fissure that she felt ran through her home. The name Cell alludes to something biological and regenerative, but also to prisons and confinement. Red Rooms of 1994 was a pair of installations, one depicting the parents' bedroom and the other depicting the child's room. Freud discusses the notion of the double, as outlined by Otto Rank in 1914, which included reflections in mirrors, shadows, guardian spirits, and the idea that originally the double was an insurance against the destruction of the ego. However, for Freud, once one's early narcissistic phase is over, the double indicates an uncanny harbinger of death. This one's the parents' room. You can just see that the reflection, that's a long mirror, and so it's reflecting what is off stage, as it were. And that's basically the viewpoint that you can see when you manage to get round the corner of the spire and see into the installation itself. And that's the child's. It's not very comforting. Yes. The parents' room is only visible to the audience either through the slits between the containing walls of worn doors, and you saw on the previous slide how you had to peer through the slits between the surrounding doors, it made a sort of spiral, or through the image being reflected in the long mirror, which you can see there. Unlike the idea of the window discussed earlier, here the viewer is placed in the uncomfortable position of being a voyeur, peering through the chinks onto the scene beyond. This also places the viewer on the same footing as the child, who would be kept out at certain times. Bourgeois repeatedly claimed that her art was an exorcism of her childhood memories, and one of her main issues was with her father, who repeatedly brought home his mistresses, and who had an affair with Louise Bourgeois' nurse. The idea of a child wandering into the parents' bedroom and either seeing or imagining the parents, or indeed the father and mistresses, having intercourse, suggests Freud's primal space. The child here, though, is not totally excluded, as the installation includes the child's xylophone and train. You can just see a tiny train there and the xylophone. It's kind of a rubber covering to the bed, which again is a bit strange to look at. Red Room Child is not simply that of a child, but contains overtones of parental control. In line with surrealist ideas about symbolism, many of the objects have layers of allegorical meaning. The bobbins of red thread both allude to her family textile business that she helped with as a child, as well as to the three fates in Greek mythology who control the apportioned length of life. When the thread is cut, your life is over. The red waxy hand suggests the casts that sculptors normally kept for reference in their studios, but the swollen, shiny redness repulses. Here Bourgeois uses the shared cultural and tactile memories. We know how these objects would feel, and it's not inviting. There are also found objects here, a case, coins and bookcase. Again, the viewer would look at these and be able to draw on their own memories of similar objects. The conflation of myth and the everyday reality collapses the stability of meaning, leaving the audience slightly confused. This allows viewers to project their own anxieties into this space. Mona Hatoum has made London and Berlin her home since the 1970s, when war broke out in the country of her upbringing, the Lebanon. This work is made from steel pins, giving the word welcome an ironic touch. Home for her is complex. Her family was exiled from the Palestine, so moved to Beirut, but they were unable to get Lebanese identity cards, so became British nationals. Hatoum considers herself a nomad, travelling the world for exhibitions and residencies. This dislocation of being in a state of flux is a contemporary reading of the Unheimlich, where one discusses where one is at home everywhere but nowhere. As Ranajit Guha has discussed, a migrant has lost the temporality and kinship of the mother country, which seems so natural when there, so that one's sense of self to oneself and to the new community falters, leaving instead a sense of homelessness. Instead of the Heimlich that Freud discussed, one is constantly engaged with difference. Edward Said's Reflections on Exile has been an important text for Hatoum. He writes that homes for the exile are always provisional. Exiles cross borders, break barriers of thought and experience, and through seeing the entire world as a foreign land, one can become aware of simultaneous dimensions of living. Homebound, as a title, refers both to going home and also being bound to and constrained by the home. The objects themselves are worn rather than pristine and create a tension. They are of the everyday, being universal necessities of dwelling. However, they have been made threatening, so that what has captivated is also a trap. It shatters the notion of the wholesomeness of the home environment. While Hatoum has said that her own family's expectations were more liberal, she grew up in a society where girls were taught to cook as part of the process of being primed for marriage. Electric cables run through the utensils that have been arranged on a Formica table with a computer program linked to them that periodically turns on and off lights hidden beneath them, and speakers amplify the buzz of the undulating current. Hard chairs, a trolley and lamp, in materials once associated with hygiene and efficiency, have become contaminated and live. They are staged behind a screen of parallel horizontal wires, at once suggesting prisons and caged animals. This combination of two narratives, as we discussed earlier with Merit Oppenheim's, was a strategy frequently used by the surrealists. And as can be seen here, the line of nails is confounded functional reality, neutrality of the iron, and it's made it much, much more threatening. So rather than just confusing like the Merit Oppenheim, this one actually is quite aggressive. Also, like many surrealists like Magritte, Hatoum has used scale to confound the expectations of the viewer. A vegetable dicer and mincer has been enlarged 21 times so that it is vast against the body of the viewer and indeed against the gallery space. It has become a Gothic, reversal of the expected. Hatoum has said that you first experience an artwork physically, with meanings and associations coming later. In an interview, she linked this work to a story of Franz Kafka, The Penal Settlement, where a newly arrived visitor encounters a maniacal officer attending to a monstrous machine which inscribes on the body of prisoner the commandment that he is meant to have contravened. It is through gradually translating the painful marks that the prisoner understands his misdemeanor. After hours of this torture, the machine pierces him through and deposits the body in a grave. If any of you have ever used one of these machines, you know, these at normal size, as a tool, you'll remember the tactile feel of the comfortable wooden handle in the right hand and the clench of the handle in the left, and the jagged movement from the vegetables being fed into the assembled things. I don't know whether any of you have, but I used to love using my grandmother's machine. With the installation, the viewer can measure themselves against the blades and believe that they too can become prepared for consumption. It makes the body feel very vulnerable. This idea of unsettling the body and through that the mind has been taken a stage further by the German artist Gregor Schneider. He has been reconfiguring a house in Ried, Germany, which was owned by the lead mine in which his family worked for generations and that underpinned the local economy. However, the area has become a ghost town because of the fumes and economic downturn, so that nature has started to take over, and as one walks around the neighbourhood, unexpected bits of pavement or domestic trees can be found. Schneider likes the idea of places that have been changed through traumatic events, and in many ways this links with surrealist interest in decay and dereliction. Well, as a house, you can see there, it looks pretty well as it always does look. But within the house, he has built walls, created rooms and spaces where one's expectations are constantly thwarted. Visitors find themselves disorientated as soon as the door is shut, as they see a labyrinthine of narrow corridors, crawl spaces and claustrophobic rooms where walls move. A whole room rotates and unexpected drafts come from the apparent windows that are actually boxed in. Even if someone has been there before, they would be disorientated, as it is a work in progress. He has lined rooms with lead so that no sound can permeate, something that both references his family history and the lead-lined death chambers of the Holocaust. Some of the rooms have the air of completion, containing furniture and family mementos. As discussed earlier, possessions under display create narratives of self that people present themselves to and others, present to themselves and others. In this house, however, there is a constant state of unease and of the narrative being disturbed. Here I'm just moving on to my last work I'll be discussing. This installation in East London continued many of the same ideas as that of Haus Totes Uhr. Schneider took over two small adjoining houses in Walden Street in East London with identical layouts and then adapted them. The houses were already small, but he made them subtly smaller so that the walls and ceiling were no longer comfortable around the body. He furnished both in 1970s furniture and fittings, such as would have been chosen by a working-class family with limited expectations. There was shopping left by the television and glasses that had been left half-drunk. There were also actors apparently performing everyday tasks in real time. The viewer, who with a partner had gained keys to both houses, had received an invitation to an at-home. Each visited one house at a time and then swapped keys after 10 minutes. They were put in an invidious position. The woman in each continued washing up, the man in the shower continued masturbating, and the child with a bin bag over his head stayed put. What was the role of the viewer? Had they strayed into a family drama, but no one took any heed of them? The houses were identical, the actors identical twins, and their performances also identical, so that having strayed into one strange saga, this was then repeated. Freud wrote how repetition could invoke feelings of the uncanny, and gave the example of unexpectedly walking into a red-light district in a provincial town in Italy. Hurriedly withdrawing, and after meandering down some more alleyways, he found himself back two more times in the same district. It was only having found himself in the familiar piazza that he no longer became lost. Visitors have said how they found the installation truly unnerving. The author Andrew O'Hagan described how his visit reawakened memories of a tenement in Glasgow that he used to pass on the way to school, where an elderly woman had been murdered. He always felt the same sense of dread, but looked up at the windows anyway, checking to see whether he'd catch sight of a ghost. As Freud discussed, the uncanny is not actually there, but develops in the mind of the viewer or the reader. Like O'Hagan, the visitors to Die Familie Schneider would calibrate their experiences against memories of dysfunctional families of uneasy films. Against The Object by Merritt Oppenheim, they would think about the tactile sensation of drinking from a furry cup. Against the works by Mona Hatoum, they would feel dwarfed and uneasy. As Jentsch and Freud discussed, the uncanny is not out there. It is not objective reality, but something that develops in the minds of the audience. Artists stage situations, frequently leaving works open to interpretation. All it requires is for the audience to reflexively engage with the works and allow them to permeate their consciousness. Thank you.
You all dumb, yeah. Surely not. Yes.
I wondered if you could tell us how initially you got interested in this artist's work. What was it about the home that interested you?
Well, actually, I have a psychoanalyst friend, and she roared with laughter when I started saying that I was sort of working on the home, because at that point we were kind of homeless ourselves. My husband had gained a job down in London. I was still up in Birmingham. We couldn't sell our house. And we were sort of kind of ricocheting between, well, several different places. And so it was kind of an uncomfortable place. And so that was part of it. But another part of it was that my first book was about contemporary crafts. And a lot of those objects are about the home. And I just love the idea of actually us as human beings dwelling. I mean, it's so fundamental to being human, isn't it? So the importance of where we dwell, how we organise our spaces, the tactile feel of even chairs, our favourite chairs, you know. So sort of all those things, the rituals of having mugs of coffee, you know, it's all actually sort of part of who we are. And it's those sort of slightly sort of unsung, slightly shady areas that, they actually make life meaningful in many ways. It's less the highlights, perhaps, but the spaces in between that become really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just sort of thinking about that because clearly there had been some fairly strange and unsettling artworks. I'm just thinking about Redon, for instance. Odile Redon, who do these very strange dreamlike structures with heads and clouds and all sorts of strange things. Some of the symbolist sculptures, again, are fairly weird. But it's never really been articulated. You know, Jentsch was the first person, perhaps, and then Freud built on that. You know, Burke had talked about the sublime being sort of placing you in a situation of awe, whereas this is somehow slightly different. You know, it's slightly more layered and slightly more about combining symbolic and the everyday, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, I think probably the late 19th century is when it probably started, partly because of the breakdown in the patronage areas. You know, they had a bit more free rein about what they could do. Does that answer your question?
No, I mean, it's fascinating to see how you worked with all the artists you showed.
Absolutely.
And
yeah. But I think the thing to, yeah, I think also the thing to remember, though, is that artists tend to be, well, kind of broad in what they decide they're going to pick up on. And so, you know, so like the Helen Chadwick, I mean, the amount of reading that she did was astonishing, you know, from, Pythagoras to sort of things about planetary systems to astronomy to architecture to Freud to, you know, and so there's actually sort of a real sort of smorgasbord, and then she sort of picked out what she wanted for any particular thing. And I think often artists do work like that. So, I mean, in a sense, obviously I only had about 40 to 50 minutes, so I was trying to sort of think, how can I make this work with a select group of artists? But obviously artists draw on different things and can create unease in different ways. Yeah, yeah. Edgar Allan Poe can be really quite, yes, odd. Yes, you're right. And some of those can be fairly odd, yes. But actually, if you think about it, Hieronymus Bosch, you know, some of those early Christian things of hell and purgatory, and, I mean, they're pretty strange. So, and dreamlike. So maybe it's always been there, but wasn't totally articulated. Any other questions? Please do ask.
I wonder if you could talk more about gender, because very many women spend more time in their homes, often studios where you would make your work might not necessarily be in a separate place, it might be adjoined to the home. Certainly if you can afford it and have the space, and that's what is often preferable. And also just thinking that where we are now, the work took place in the home effectively. I wonder if you have anything to say about that. The place of work.
Yes. I mean, there's several strands to that. I mean, certainly in the early 1970s, when Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapira, for instance, went around looking for women artists, because they really weren't written about at all, so they just drove up to different people's homes, and they found that sort of people were making work in the kitchens and all the rest of it, and so they had children crawling around, and they were trying to sort of cook meals, make art, look after children, and all the rest of it, all at the same time. So I mean, that certainly has been a theme. And I think there are a lot of artists who work in those sort of circumstances, just sheerly for practicality, also for expense. You know, studios are expensive. But then if you think about people like Helen Chadwick and the Acme Studios, quite a lot of those do combine home with studio. And Helen Chadwick's place along Beck Road, same with all these ones, where sort of downstairs were the studios, upstairs were the homes. So all you had to do was sort of go down, make your cup of coffee, and you were there. Actually, Lisa Milroy, I don't know whether any of you have seen her work. She's, is she head of painting at the Slade? She is, yes. She's done this wonderful sort of cartoon almost of her going to her studio on her bicycle, feeding the cat, and turning on Radio 4. She goes through all these different stages of not making art, which is really rather nice, and I think she finally ends up doing something, but it's just a lovely little sort of cartoon that she sort of drew of her day in the studio. But I think there are different ways of working it, because I know some artists, they like not being at home, but I also know that for many people, the home was very enriching. You know, Cornelia Parker worked in the late 80s at home, as have many people, yes.
I was interested in what you said about the work of people who are in exile,
yeah,
and sort of the disjunction often between, you know, different cultures and people's homes in different, you know, they've moved country, perhaps sometimes in difficult circumstances, yeah, and different homes. We talked about Mona Hutun. And of course, it's interesting that obviously you're making the Freudian comparison. This is Freud's home. Freud was an exile,
exactly,
and it's a slightly different,
yep,
take on him. But I just wondered if you could say, because I thought that was very interesting about that sort of introduction of the uncanny, because of the different perceptions of the people of
been forced to have as their homes have changed.
Yeah, yeah. I must admit, this is sort of towards the beginning of my sort of exploration of this idea, which is going to be developed more. But it is this sort of notion that as sort of society has developed, and there's so many more people migrating, you know, sort of it's much, much more globalized and interrelated, that actually, where are you at home? You know, and that becomes, and we all have a sort of bricolage of identity anyway. You know, I sort of think of myself as being English, European, human, you know, there's sort of a range of things that we all sort of kind of think of ourselves as. But I think for the exile, it does become particularly tricky, because normally we feel like we can go home and we feel home somewhere. But for somebody who's left home, the world moves on without them as well. So even if they return back to their home country, that's changed anyway. So therefore, where are they home? The whole thing's become situated very, very differently. And that is much more of a sort of contemporary reading of the uncanny, to do with the contemporary condition. Well, thank you ever so much for coming. It's been a real pleasure. So thank you.
Yes, and thanks to you.